An organization called Aldhern Institute, which is working with the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration on a project that helps in turn encourage mental health services and policies for Americans, is coming to Northwest Indiana for a presentation tomorrow. And we're going to find out more about that presentation. It's going to be co-sponsored by the Indiana Parenting Institute. Elizabeth Burden is with us from Aldhern Institute to talk about what the agency she works for does and how it fits into what the IPI is going to discuss here. We should mention, too, that, by the way, that the Indiana Governor's Task Force on Drug Enforcement, Treatment, and Prevention turned out a final report not long ago, and IPI was listed in that report as being one of the best such organizations in the state to deal as a substance abuse disorder treatment best practice. And Elizabeth, tell us, if you will, what that's going to mean, I suppose, for folks here in Indiana, in particular, how you folks with your institute deal with it.
So the panel that IPI, under the auspices of the Greater Gary Wellness Partnership, is sponsoring is a conversation about family-oriented or family-centered recovery. And I think it's an important conversation to have in the context of the recently released recommendations from the Governor's Task Force, because we often think of addiction or alcohol use, substance use disorder, as something that only affects individuals. And therefore, we often target the treatment and supports at individuals. But the fact of the matter is that individuals are part of families. And so when there is a person with a substance use disorder who then enters recovery, that also impacts the entire family. And so we really need to look at providing recovery supports, not just to the individual who is in recovery from addiction, but children, families, partners, spouses, other important people in that person's lives in order to ensure their long-term recovery. So that's what the conversation of panel is going to be about.
I was going to say, it seems that these days, in particular here in Northwest Indiana, as it is in much of the country, there's a very serious opioid addiction problem, a crisis in some cases. We have people with overdose deaths and people recovering from overdose. There's some particularly very nasty strains of substance abuse out there that's happening. People taking fentanyl, which unfortunately has been laced with heroin and makes it extremely dangerous, fatal in most cases if they're not able to be treated in time. And obviously, if you say family members get wrapped up in this too, it's something that is just one individual, it becomes the whole family, does it not?
Well, I think that may be true for substance use itself, as you're saying. And that's what we're seeing with this contemporary opioid epidemic. I think you're exactly right, that it's impacting whole families and whole communities in a much different way than maybe we've seen with other drugs or drug epidemics in the recent past. But I also think that we need to put out there that there is the message of hope and recovery, mm-hmm. again, for individuals and families, whether it be through medication-assisted treatment, moving on to medication-assisted recovery. And to me, recovery means it's beyond just promoting sobriety. It means rebuilding health, home, community, and purpose for people who may have been engaged in using opioids and or alcohol. Because we don't want to forget that even though we're in the midst of an opioid crisis, that alcohol use is still really the most significant drug of choice, if you will, for people who have substance use disorder.
Now, the Indiana Parenting Institute, in cooperation with the agencies that we've talked about, is sponsoring a presentation in Maryville on Friday to talk about this in more detail, and particularly to bring in together the fact that the IPI has picked up this designation of being a substance abuse disorder treatment best practices organization. And how this, of course, is to say, we talk about his parents, how it deals with family members, and you just mentioned, Elizabeth, here about that. Who are some of the other people that you're aware of that are going to be involved in this presentation that's going to happen here in Maryville?
Well, we are helping to support, through the Aldhern Institute, Deb Werner, who is the director, project director for a training and technical assistance center related to women and families, is going to come in to participate in the panel. And she's going to talk a lot about the role of family-centered recovery and breaking intergenerational addiction, moving to really help families rebuild, connecting families to other families in recovery, a lot of the things that are really important in building a family-oriented, recovery-oriented system of support. I also know that there are local experts that are going to be a part of the panel as well, including local treatment experts, a local law enforcement expert as well, to be able to tell what their agencies are doing in Northwest Indiana to help families recover from addiction.
I understand that the local law enforcement official that's going to be participating in the in this particular program is Porter County Sheriff David Reynolds, who, of course, is dealing with a very serious problem with opioid addiction and how it affects families, certainly in his communities and in Porter County. So it'll be interesting to see what he brings to the presentation as well. This presentation, by the way, tomorrow, it'll be held at the IBEW 697 Hall, which is on Mississippi Street in Merrillville. If you're interested in attending, please get hold of the folks at the Indiana Parenting Institute right away and let them know that you're interested, because you can kind of register for the event. It doesn't cost anything, but they would like to know if you're going to participate, being a member of that as well, too. When you work with other organizations, Elizabeth, you talk about the problems that are substance abuse, regardless of what it is, whether it happens to be opioids or even alcohol. What kinds of programs do you talk with them about to let them know that there is help out there? And as you said, there is hope for these family members and families that are struck by this addiction.
In many locations, communities are building what we would call a recovery-oriented system of care. And what that means is it's more than just the substance use disorder treatment, more than the addiction treatment organization. It includes things like peer support. So people can learn from others with lived experience of addiction what it means to build a life in recovery. There are other kinds of recovery supports, like recovery housing, like help with employment and job skills, help with life skills. It's things like sober active activities, social life, because building a life in recovery means more than just being sober. It means being able to live a full quality life, rebuilding connections with people who also have an interest in health and recovery in a different way than associates who may have been ones that we socialize with when in the throes of addiction or alcoholism.
Is there a website or more information people can get if they'd like to find out more about what the organization you work with Alterin Institute and what the SAMHSA people have are on the agenda to help deal with the problems, help family members deal with the problems?
Sure. So the Altarum Institute website is Altarum, Altarum.org. And the SAMHSA website is SAMHSA, that's SAMHSA.gov. And the SAMHSA website has a lot of resources for people who are looking for services in their local community. There's a treatment finder tool. There are downloadable guides and resource packets and the like about addiction, about mental health and mental illness, about prevention. For youth and families, there are just a wide range of resources that are available on the SAMHSA website.
Elizabeth Burton is a member of the staff of the Alterin Institute, which is working with the SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is a part of HHS, talking about the issues of substance abuse and helping it combat addiction and the generational impact that it has on the family. In fact, that's one of the topics that will come up during this discussion on Friday at the IBEW Local 697 Hall in Merrillville. Elizabeth, thank you very much for the information. Thank you for bringing out all this to light. We hope that that you're able to at least through your colleagues, get the word out and help more people to be able to resolve the issues that they happen to have as a family member with substance abuse and the like. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
The Lake County Council approved a bill that would pay the food vendor for the Lake County Jail. The action was taken after the council members were assured by the sheriff that bookkeeping issues that have delayed payments to the vendors would be corrected. Here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore.
Yes, motion carries 6-1. Any further business in front of this council?
At the emergency meeting of the Lake County Budget Committee, the council voted to pay an outstanding bill from the Lake County Sheriff's food vendor. The $80,000 invoice was a month overdue, and the vendor had threatened to stop food deliveries to the county jail. The council agreed to issue payment, and there was no interruption of service. The issue is part of a larger disagreement between the Sheriff's Department and the Lake County Council. Some were a year overdue. It resulted in the creation of a Sheriff's Budget Oversight Committee to look into why there are constant budget overruns at the Lake County Sheriff's Department. Lake County Sheriff John Buncich.
We've worked it out, and once you get together and you communicate, you see what both sides have to say, that, and now we can move forward.
It's not a vote of confidence. This is simply regarding a meeting that we had this morning in which Melanie Dillon and the sheriff explained the expenditures, and I think we're moving in the right direction.
Jamal Washington submitted the ordinance to form the Sheriff Budget Oversight Committee. They recently held their first meeting in advance of the emergency budget meeting.
Well, after the meeting we had today in jail oversight and sheriff oversight committee, hopefully we can put everything in the right place and start getting things done in an orderly fashion.
This is a vote of the right thing. We received a service, and we should pay our bills. So, you know, I'm confident that we did the right thing.
Council President Ted Bilski.
I think it's a confidence in saying that the bills will be submitted in a timely fashion.
In Crown Point, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
At the State House, Indiana House members joined Democratic State Representative Chuck Mosley of Portage in approving a bill that would make it easier for veterans to join the conductor trainee programs across the state. The resolution urges Congress to enact legislation that would require the National Department of Veterans Affairs to certify all licensure conductor trainee programs for GI Bill benefits. Mosley says this, in turn, will provide opportunities for both veterans and for the railroad industry here in Indiana.
By giving them this additional benefit that they went to war or they served their country for and that they earned. So if they've earned this GI Bill benefit, this will just encourage them to look to the railroad industry for jobs. And there are a lot of job opportunities out there that aren't being filled, and this could close that gap.
Representative Mosley says that the resolution is crucial because Indiana's railroads are among the top employers who hire veterans across the state. The measure also requires all railroad conductor programs to be considered on-the-job training that would allow veterans to take advantage of those essential jobs. What you're hearing right now is music from the Billy Foster Quartet, and the Billy Foster Quartet is going to be presenting a jazz history concert on the IU Northwest campus here later this month as part of the IU Northwest Black History Month activities. And with us to talk about this concert and some of the other activities as well, we have the director of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs at IU Northwest, James Wallace, with us. Mr. Wallace, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us an idea of some of the events, of course, have happened so far during the month, and this seems to be, I guess, the great musical celebration kind of climaxes of the month, does it not?
Yes, this is correct.
What was, in coming up with the idea of creating this jazz history concert, where did the Billy Foster Quartet play into this, and what are they going to be presenting to the audience when they come to the Berglund Auditorium at the Savannah Center on Tuesday, February 28th?
Well, when we celebrate Black History Month, an important aspect of you know, our country is our music, and jazz is a singularly American form of music, American contribution, and we certainly want to celebrate that. And it passes so many different genres, and it impacts so many other realms of music, so we wanted to celebrate that and have it on our campus. Billy Foster, who happens to teach music here on our campus, suggested that he can provide a historical, entertaining evening for our campus, and we said, well, why not?
Well, I was going to say that it's interesting, and certainly he's certainly appropriately been involved in jazz music. He's also been involved, of course, as a member of for many years the Valparaiso University Jazz Quartet, along with his colleagues that he had worked with over there. So I can see why he certainly can take a look at the history and bring something to the genre, can't he?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And the other members of his quartet are, you know, no less familiar to the region. Bruce Evans, he was a instructor also at Valpo and retired orchestra teacher in the Gary Community Schools. Lanny Turner, the percussionist, has also been around. Carl Cohen studied at Berkeley and at Indiana University as well. So, you know, all of them have a connection to the region. So we certainly want to celebrate their talents.
Tell us about some of the discussions that you've no doubt had with Billy on the types of music he's going to bring up. How is he going to look at each of these different eras of jazz music, going all the way back to New Orleans and working way through the years coming up to where we are today?
Well, he's going to, you know, start off with some of the New Orleans, as you mentioned, and talk about some of the free-flowing syncopated rhythms that they had back then. Move into the bebop area with the smaller quartets and the faster pace and complex tunes. Spend some time with hard bop as well, with the smaller trios and quartets with the simple melodies and lots of repetition that comes there. Move through the swing era, with his ballroom dancing style and large bands, and, you know, not a lot of improvisation there. So he's going to share, you know, some of all of those genres of jazz, and you'll perform some of those pieces along with the vocalist, Renee Miles Foster, who's going to join them as well. And, you know, not only share the styles, but then explain, you know, where some of this comes from and how it impacts the music that we listen to today.
Now, we know, obviously, that the people who have grown up with this music through the years are certainly very familiar with it, very appreciative of it. What do you hope that this jazz history concert that the Billy Foster Quartet will be able to bring to IU Northwest will be able to make a difference to help teach younger people, those maybe that aren't familiar with jazz or not familiar with some of these older genres?
Well, the exposure is always important. Being able to remember perhaps a more peaceful time in our nation's history, and
yes,
enjoy some of the music and remember what that was like, and how the music has touched, you know, many lives through the years. I hope that our students will come to appreciate the history of that and where some of the foundations were laid for some of the music that they listen to today, and maybe recognize some of the melodies that they may see popping up in some of the popular tunes that they are listening to today. So I hope they are able to make that connection.
I know that some people even say today that they even go back and they say they must know something within their own careers, singers especially, to even people like Billie Holiday. A lot of people have listened to Billie Holiday music. Even I understand Frank Sinatra, even when he was a young man, said he used to wear out the grooves of Billie Holiday records listening to how she happened to style songs, how she sold songs. And that in turn is how, and we know that many artists in the years after even Frank Sinatra into today, I suppose, have said that they owe something to the early jazz artists, and in particular to people like Billie Holiday and Sarah Vaughan and other people as well that have been able to show their distinctive styles in jazz.
Indeed, these are all very important people who are worth remembering. And, you know, we take this opportunity to not only honor their memory, celebrate their legacies, but enjoy the music that they left behind.
We're talking with James Wallace. He's the director of the IU Northwest Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs. As Black History Month winds down at the end of February, one of the great events coming up, not only talking history, but great music as well, too, is a jazz history concert that features the Billy Foster Quartet. It'll be at 6 o'clock in the evening on Tuesday, February 28th. at the Bruce Berglund Auditorium at the Savannah Center on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. You can check out the IU Northwest website to find out more, but just make plans to be there. It's a great concert that's open to everybody, and audience participation is encouraged. That's how it's put here on the information, that that you should take advantage of a chance to not only celebrate some Black history and in particular some jazz history as well, too, with a great group called the Billy Foster Quartet. Mr. Wallace, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. We hope to get a great crowd for this event on Tuesday evening, the 28th, and we hope to see you there.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Remember, this is free and it's open to the public.
That's right. It's very important. Here's a chance to take advantage of something on the IU Northwest campus on February 28th. And thank you very much, James Wallace, for being with us today.
Thank you again. Take care.
Thank you. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This week we've been looking at the legislative priorities survey results from some of the Northwest Indiana delegation to the Indiana Senate. And we wrap up this week with District 2 Senator Lonnie Randolph's survey. The topic on his recent email newsletter begins with, "We asked, you answered." Before the start of the 2017 legislative session, Senator Randolph asked residents for their thoughts on a number of the Senate Democrats' legislative proposals. And after tallying the responses, here are the questions and the results. To the question, do you support or oppose a statewide expansion of the state's pre-kindergarten program? 78% of Senator Randolph's constituents who responded to the poll support the idea, 21% oppose it. Rather than legislators drawing their own district boundaries, do you support or oppose the establishment of an independent, nonpartisan redistricting committee? 84% of the respondents support it, and 15% opposed it. To the question, do you support or oppose raising the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10? 81% of Senator Randolph's constituents who responded to the question on the poll support it, and 18% oppose it. Do you support or oppose legislation to increase voter access, including more early voting options and expanded poll hours? 77% of Randolph's poll respondents support it. 22% oppose it. And 81% of those who responded to Senator Randolph's poll said they support the policies to provide paid leave to care for a sick family member or a child. 16% oppose it. And finally, in the questions, do you support or oppose the amendment of the state's civil rights statutes to include protections for the LGBT community? 66% say they support it. 30% oppose it. And that's a look at the legislative priorities from the surveys that were turned in from some of our state lawmakers at the start of this coming session here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Howie Politics Indiana creator, editor, and publisher Brian Howie has put out on his latest online newsletter, which of course you can subscribe to if you're interested in catching it, and a lot of conversation with not only his but other contributors to the site as well, too, about the Trump administration, and in particular about our former governor and now Vice President Mike Pence. The latest column that Brian has out there available to take a look at is entitled Pence's Long Game in the Trump Twilight Zone. And Brian Howie's with us from his office in Indianapolis to talk about it. Thanks very much for being with us, Brian, and tell us why you came up with the headline talking about Mike Pence's long game.
Well, he's always looked at things very strategically and takes his time doing it. You know, he ran for Congress twice and lost in 1988 and 1990. He took some time off, joined a think tank, the Indiana Policy Review Foundation, and launched his statewide radio and TV show. So he spent a decade kind of getting in the grain of Indiana politics from a broadcasting perspective, and then ran for Congress and won in 2000. And then I think that after 12 years in Congress, he had ambitions to get to the White House. He figured he needed some executive experience, and so he passed on a presidential race in 2012 and ran for governor. So he's got that on his resume. matter of fact, I'm literally writing a column right now about his legacy as governor, which, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. But so Pence is he's going to stand back. He's going to make a long term assessment and then go for where he thinks his instincts will serve him best.
Taking a look at Mike Pence and how he's tried to fit in with Trump administration, some of the events of recent weeks have kind of gotten in his way, in particular the Flynn incident involving what at the time was a national security advisor who's no longer in that job, all because of some contact with the Russians during the campaign. Tell us how Mike Pence seemed to have gotten maybe burned by some of that, and it's not his fault. He was kind of embarrassed by all of this.
Well, you know, I've likened the Trump White House to kind of a juxtaposition of the movies Mad Max, Network, Alice in Wonderland, and then throw in a little Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. And it's kind of like a presidency on magic mushrooms. It's just kind of a strange thing. There's no org chart. There's loyalty tests. Trump is famous as an executive for playing off key aides against each other. He always looks for that loyalty. And so that's the mix Mike Pence finds himself in. The most perplexing thing about that is President Trump was informed by the Department of Justice about Flynn's lying, and yet they sent Mike Pence out on CBS Face the Nation, where he repeated the lies, and then he realized he got burned. His aides said he was blindsided. And, you know, that's something that President Trump should have told him. I mean, he knew. And that's the one problem I have with the Trump presidency here is the truth, facts don't seem to matter. We're now in the age of alternative facts, which, you know, most of us, if you talked about that to your parents, they tell you that, well, that's a lie. You know?
That would have gotten your mouth washed out with soap, you know, like what happened to Ralphie in A Christmas Carol. You know, if you lied, you'd pay the consequences.
Yeah, and so you know, the Washington Post had a story that in the first 33 days of the Trump presidency, they've documented 132 lies or mostly falsehoods. So when we talked during the election last year, you know, I talked about how this might be the first post-truth election, and now I think we're into the first post-truth presidency here, where the facts just don't matter. They're going to say whatever they want to say, and then if they get called out on the media, you know, Trump goes, well, they're fake news, and, you know, he tries to paint all. As a matter of fact, I guess I'm an enemy of the American people in the eyes of President Trump, which, you know, I find very offensive, and I'm assuming you as a journalist would.
Yes, I'm not happy about that, too, and I don't think it helps us any. We have enough problems that we're dealing with as members of the media and trying to not only get the truth out and to explain things as easily and as best as we possibly can, and to have things obfuscated as they are from the Trump administration certainly doesn't help any.
Well, and so Vice President Pence is sitting there kind of hovering around, you know, this circus, I'm not sure where it's going to lead him here. It's, you know, I think he may be finding himself in some untenable positions. We've had a number of vice presidents that served under Franklin Roosevelt, for instance. Thomas Marshall, the former Indiana governor, was Vice President Woodrow Wilson. They fell out of favor and actually got replaced on the ticket. So I don't think the president can fire a vice president, but, you know, that's one of the big parlor games in Washington right now is, you know, is Pence going to find himself on the outs or not? And, you know, so part of the long game that I was talking about in the column is, you know, he may be in a kind of a holding pattern here if he falls out of favor with Trump, or he finds himself that he can't defend, you know, some kind of crazy rhetoric. Does he just lay low and then wait and see if Trump serves out a full term or not? I mean, during the campaign, Trump was asked, "Are you going to fill out serve your full term?" And he said, "Well, I'll let you know." You know, which,
well,
I found astounding. You know, why would you say that? And he may get very frustrated with Congress if he doesn't get his way. This is a guy that if he doesn't get his way, he lashes out. And he's also lashing out at all sorts of American institutions, obviously the news media, the Fourth Estate. He's taken on the judiciary, calling them so-called judges. He has lambasted the political parties. He's compared the U.S. intelligence services to Nazi Germany. And so this is a guy that's really taking roundhouse swings at the very institutions that over more than two centuries have made this the greatest nation that this planet has ever seen. And so that's kind of where Mike Pence is. He's got the front row seat to this.
And let's hope that he's, like you say, not though he may not be a direct participant in this because he's only the vice president, you can say if he can manage to stay off to the side, far enough off to the side, so he doesn't get completely covered with mud, then he might be able to ride this thing out?
Sure, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm sure you can never get him to say that. Matter of fact, you know, he'll talk to the national media. He hasn't talked to Indiana media in like 8 or 9 months here. So I don't know, you know, what he's thinking. But he's going to keep his cards close to the vest here.
Well, we'll certainly see what happens as the episode of the Trump Twilight Zone continues and the impact that it is likely to have on the former governor and now Vice President Mike Pence. Brian Howie is the creator, the editor and publisher of Howie Politics Indiana. Brian, thanks for the update. We'll keep an eye on the columns and look forward to the next column, the one that you mentioned that you're working on that's going to talk more about the legacy of Mike Pence, and we hope to get some interesting comments back from you again soon.
Okay.
The Trump administration is changing the federal stance on guidelines that protect transgender students' rights in schools. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Peter Ballin and Rosen reports, it's sent a ripple across the Hoosier State.
Last May, the Obama administration threatened to withhold federal funding from schools if they forced transgender students to use bathrooms that don't align with their gender identity. The Trump administration is reversing that, saying schools can set their own rules on bathrooms transgender students can use. Andrew Clampett with Monroe County Community School Corporation says Bloomington schools will continue policies he says respect students.
All bathrooms are clearly identified as gender neutral, and those are available to all of our students.
Further south, Dan Sherry, the superintendent of North Spencer Country School Corporation, says the government's new stance reflects his area's cultural viewpoints.
Yeah, it helps us as far as not being mandated to follow other people's expectations.
The ACLU of Indiana calls the change horrible and says it sends a message that the Trump administration will not protect transgender kids from discrimination. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Peter Ballinon Rosen.
A Senate committee approved a bill on Wednesday that requires parents and guardians to be notified if their child tries to seek an abortion. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us that it permits no exceptions, even in cases of rape and incest.
Indiana abortion law requires a child under age 18 to receive parental consent for an abortion. If the child doesn't want to inform her parents, she can go to court to receive a judicial waiver. A proposed bill would require the parents be notified of that judicial proceeding, no matter what. Meaning, as one lawmaker pointed out, if a father rapes his underage daughter and she wants an abortion, she'd have to notify her father first. Jane Glynn is an Indianapolis attorney who's represented girls in those judicial hearings. She says notifying parents could have serious consequences.
Which means that these girls are going to be forced out while they're pregnant, without any resources, without shelter. They may become homeless.
But Indiana Right to Life attorney Corinne Purvis says parents have the right to be involved in the process.
Then they have the opportunity to be heard and present evidence to the court. And who's better to testify to the competency of the child than the parent?
Committee leaders acknowledge issues with the bill that they say will be fixed on the Senate floor. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Lakeshore Public Radio Sarah Opat talks with an unconventional punk rock cover band.
We're listening to Horror Business, a song by iconic punk band The Misfits, covered by punk rock piano tribute band Walk Among Us. What makes this cover band stand out is how they reinvent the music by changing the instrumentation. Instead of guitars, a staple of punk music, they use two pianos, a bass, and the drums.
I think it creates a pretty cool, different kind of sound, and I get to thrash on my piano, which is pretty rad.
Sarah Van Lanningham. She plays the piano in Walk Among Us and also happens to be a classically trained piano player and teacher. Sarah first heard the Misfits 15 years ago. She was 15 and they made a huge impression on her.
I remember the energy of the crowd and the energy of the band was like something I had not experienced before. And I never forgot that. It stuck with me. It stuck with me all through music school. And everybody I knew that was my friends, people in the underground, you know, punk rockers, people like metal, people like rock, everybody likes the Misfits.
Drummer from Walk Among Us, Nate Phillips, was more of a metalhead until he heard the Misfits. The story goes, Phillips discovered the Misfits after hearing metal band Metallica cover one of their songs.
A trip to Best Buy later, and I have a couple Misfits CDs in my possession. I know nothing about the like back catalog of the band or the history or anything, and I dove in, and that was when I was about 16 years old, and I don't think there's probably been more than a week in my life where I haven't listened to like at least one Misfits song. Well, I'm just losing a clue. That there's really something about the song that just transcends time. A lot of bands have trouble. They sound like they're stuck in a certain era of time. And I think the Misfits don't really sound like they're from any time, but their own time. And I think that's a really interesting quality for them to have. That's what's kind of always drawn me to them.
Yeah, I think that's true of art in general. When you have something that you connect to on that very special level, you know, I don't really know how to describe that connection, but... you know, you can have that with as a musician, as an artist, a visual artist, any of that type of stuff. When you have that connection, I think that that is a thing that transcends time.
Walk Among Us does something no one else has done in the history of punk rock piano. They set fire the passion for Misfits and create a distinctive, cohesive sound. Van Lanningham says...
We're doing something a little bit different with punk rock music. There's no guitars. Mm-hmm. It's me on the piano doing the rhythm and kind of lead parts of the guitar, so in place of a guitar, I guess you could say. And then Veronica plays what we call dirty piano, which is pretty cool. It's like we put it through a distortion pedal, and it gives that like old fuzz, the old like 70s cool fuzzy sound over the top of it. So she's playing it on a keyboard. And then Nate plays drums and does all the cool Misfits drumming, and Rob's playing the bass.
Almost 5 years ago, I met these Misfit members in the human flesh. We were at a kitchen table playing Cards Against Humanity. I also babysit for the lead singer, Veronica's three-year-old Oliver, who also sings the Misfits song 138 and plays the piano with his feet. Back in August of 2016, I saw Walk Among Us perform their first show at Big Shots in Valpo. Since then, they've played in Chicago and Indianapolis, as well as other regional venues. The members of Walk Among Us are family. We grill burgers and do classical stretch with Miranda Esmond White on Mondays. The love for Walk Among Us is real. Their next show is this Saturday, February 25th in Lansing at Royal Skate Shop, where they will be headlining. Doors open at 5 p.m. Also, they're headed to Chicago to play Martyrs on February 27th and at the Underground Lounge March 4th, also in Chicago. You can reach out to Walk Among Us through Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sarah Opet.
Kyle Meredith talks with the guys from St. Motel about their newest record on The Speed of Sound.
The Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith.
Saying that I dare you not to at least bob your head along with St. Motel's move isn't really a fair challenge. It's near impossible, as long as you're not immobile in a neck brace. and maybe even then your body would find a way to hit the groove. It was the lead-off single to their newest record, Saint Motelevision, which announced that they weren't just any pop rock band, but finely tuned craftsmen. With the band's AJ Jackson Jr., I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound. The new record, Saint Motelevision, so much fun. It's really great. But, you know, heading back to that EP, I mean, that really did seem like it blew up.
Yeah, the EP definitely kind of brought us into a new, I think, awareness of the band. Because, you know, we've been an independent band for such a long time, playing all six dive bars over this great country. And then the EP kind of brought us to Europe for a little bit, and then back to the U.S., and we were kind of received anew.
Were those songs written before or at the same time as the tracks that ended up making the new full length?
For Saint Motelevision?
Yeah.
It was kind of a mixture of stuff from around the time of the EP all the way to like about a month before we started mixing in June. And some of it was written on the road while we were touring on the EP. Mm-hmm. Some of it was written back in downtown LA. And yeah, it was kind of just a nonstop process. It wasn't as much of, all right, we're going to go make a record, let's disappear for a month and get it done. It was kind of just ongoing for that entire couple of years.
Those songs that came later in the process, did you feel like, you know, there was any difference in writing them because of the success of what was happening with the EP?
No, I don't think that there were any kind of pressures on us to go a certain way. You know, there's basically just a batch of tons of songs, just never stopped writing, and probably 100, and then we would narrow it down from there. And then you know, we produced out maybe 25 of them with Lars Telford, Tim Pagnotta, and Frederick Tay. And from those, it got narrowed down to those 10. So it was kind of like an ongoing democratic process of narrowing it down. So it was a bit different as far as an album approach for us. You can be you.
A lot of times when bands use more than one producer, even if it's just two, you can sort of hear the difference, but I don't really get that in this. It still sounds like an album.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of that has to do with the songs kind of start in-house where the production really begins with all the songs, and I take them a certain way, and then these other producers we work with kind of add their own insights, and we change things out or replace them, or it's kind of like it all comes from the same foundation. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a cohesiveness there, and that plus we had the wonderful Mark Needham and Dave Cooley you know, mix everything and master everything, so there's a cohesiveness there. But yeah, they are a mixture of different vibes and different places, I think, that we were, but there's a thread, hopefully, that you can weave between everything on the album. That's the goal. Kind of a bit of a journey through all the songs, but something that feels cohesive and same with Television. Whoa, Elise, Norma Jean,
Patty Boyd, and Carol King. You know, some compliments. The song Elisa, how it breaks down. It seems to me like into almost an old Hollywood sort of sound.
Yeah, I mean, we've never really had much of a guideline, you know, when we're approaching this stuff, which has been good and bad. Like, I think, you know, that's kind of why maybe it took us so long to catch on. We kind of just did what we kind of liked, and sometimes that wasn't really what was the craze at the moment. But it just seems like, you know, as long as you're making a song that you're trying to go for like a timeless, just focus on, you know, I guess, structure and lyrics, and I think that's kind of all you can hope for.
Get born,
I wouldn't mind hearing about one of the songs specifically, and that's Born Again, because it's fun, but it also seems like you're playing around with religion on that. Like, what's going on in that song, and how did it come about?
Yeah, that song, it's funny, that definitely has been getting a lot of reaction, mostly for that, I think. It's interesting, too, because it's kind of walking a line where you're not really sure where it's pointing, and it's based kind of on a story of a friend of mine when I was growing up, and I don't think it's taken any side, really. I think the way I see it, there's almost kind of a innocent, naive aspect to the concept of being born again, you know, starting and as illogical as it might be, and as weird as it was for me at that point in my life, I don't know. I think we're not taking a stab at anybody, really. This is kind of just, you know, interpret it how you will. And people, I guess, on both sides of any issue, people are reading it different ways, which is totally fine and kind of fun to see.
A.J. Jackson Jr. of St. Motel, whose album St. Motelevision is available everywhere now. Hey, for more of my interviews, you can head to Facebook and Twitter at Kyle Meredith. And thanks to Chris Allman for co-producing and editing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at the Speed of Sound.
Speed of Sound, Kyle Meredith, can be heard Tuesdays and Thursdays here on Regionally Speaking. Podcasts of the show on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Just go to the Programs tab. And as a reminder, Season 2 of Speed of Sound wraps up next week. On this week's Shelf Discovery, Kristen explores the challenges of young love with the four characters in Julie Pinnell's The Young Wives Club.
Skip date night and stay in with some chocolates and a book, because this week's Discovery explores the trials of young love. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm your host, Kristen Dreyer Kramer, from nightsandweekends.com. Young love isn't always easy. After all, in our teens and early 20s, we're still trying to figure out our own lives. So bringing another person in can add drama along with the romance. And four young women struggle to balance their lives and loves in author Julie Pennell's The Young Wives Club. The story travels to a small Louisiana town where people rarely wait to settle into their lives before settling down. Four very young women believe they've all found the one, but each one faces challenges. Claire is starting a family with increasingly distant Gavin. Laura dropped out of school to follow husband Brian's suddenly uncertain football dreams. Gabby has found the perfect guy, one who doesn't know the real her. And Madison hopes her relationship with a rich, lonely, older man will help her win the man she loves. Now, the Young Wives Club weaves four stories together to offer readers a look at the challenges of young love. These four characters deal with the same issues that many of us have faced at some point in our lives. For the most part, though, the outcomes are too obvious for everyone but the characters. Readers will quickly determine how it'll all turn out while the main characters continue to flounder and fumble. And while some of that is understandable, the four interwoven stories about lies and anxiety and enabling can be frustrating. At times, the stories seem to melt together, and you might struggle to tell the characters apart. And while each character has her ups and downs, the only one who stays generally likable is Laura, because she's also the quickest to stand up for herself. And though the other characters all have their moments of clarity, Laura's early awakening will help readers wade through the other marital messes. But is it worth fighting for love with these four young brides? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say borrow it, but only if you're prepared for the drama. If you're looking for romance and comedy, you'll be disappointed, but you may learn some lessons about the give and take of relationships along the way. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. The Young Wives Club by Julie Pennell is 296 romantically challenging pages long and is available from Emily Bessler Books. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com.
And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
Dedicated to helping busy readers wade through the shelves and shelves of options to discover books that are often worth their month of limited reading time, Shelf Discovery can be heard here on Thursdays on Regionally Speaking as Kristen Dreyer Kramer offers listeners a brief look inside the pages of a new book. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Thanks for being with us. Back with you on Monday.